see Italians, some of the early people that do photochemistry.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You never got, you have one paper.
Yeah, a little bit, but not all that much. Everything's taken care of on that.
Yeah,
I sent the facts.
I received that letter.
Okay.
I want to give you one more.
Sure, give it to me. We'll take care of this also. I don't know what happened.
Thank you very much.
I don't know what happened with the other one, but we'll take
care of it. Probably the mismanaged or somehow.
Well, whatever. Yeah. You never know. But anyway, we'll take care of it. Okay. Yes, Cimo Chan, whatever the guy's name was in Milan, did organophotochemistry. Well, some inorganic as well, some cyanide complexes, I guess. But mostly organophotochemistry by putting things out in the sunlight.
Yes. But then later on, when the big move into the photochemistry of inorganic materials began,
I never got involved, really.
Yeah.
That's right.
I was going to ask you why. You have a little bit, but not.
I don't know. Arthur Adamson really was the guy that did that. Carosetti in Italy was the guy that started it there. In our case, I think by that time we were well into the metal carbonyl stuff, and we were just doing the thermal substitutions, although these things are known to photochemically active and very high quantum yields and so forth. But we didn't get involved with the photochemistry, and there was no real reason that I know why we didn't. Things were going so well without getting involved with the photochemistry, so we didn't bother. And that was being taken care of very nicely by other people, Harry Gray and Mark Brighton, of course, and some people in Mark Brighton at Penn State wrote a book on photochemistry of organometallic. The little bit that we did was because we stumbled on some chemistry that came along as a result of the discovery of dinitrogen as a ligand. That was discovered in the mid-60s, I believe, by Allen and Senoff with the ruthenium compound. And if you think of dinitrogen, it is isoelectronic with carbon monoxide. So even when Andy Wojcicki was here and we were doing metal carbonyl chemistry, we put some dinitrogen and dicobalt octacarbonyl in one of Hermann Pines' bombs, you know, and revved up the pressure of dinitrogen, hoping to make a dinitrogen compound, because to us, you know, I'm pretty pedestrian in my theory, I just count electrons, and if it's isoelectronic, it ought to have some tendency maybe to react, but it didn't. And then later, when it was discovered, under certain these circumstances, that it did behave as a ligand, then everybody jumped on the bandwagon. Taube, us, everybody else, wanting to really exploit this as much as possible, and particularly the bio inorganic chemists wanting to understand nitrogenase and how it works, you know, and the inorganic chemists hopefully wanting to activate the nitrogen-nitrogen bond to, I don't know whether they're going to compete with the Haber process or what, but anyway, do something. And we we decided we knew how to make some of these using the Zitto compound, feridium, I guess, initially, and then rhodium and so forth. And in the process of doing this, which we got to work nicely, and we think it goes through a nitrene intermediate, it was noticed that these compounds, these even in the solid state, the white crystals would take on a gray appearance, and clearly we immediately began to suspect that they were photochemically active, because the Zitto groups can be photolyzed to give off dinitrogen and so forth. So that's how we ended up doing a little bit of photochemistry, just as it pertained to that system, which we didn't continue beyond just publishing a few papers.
Was there anyone here doing photochemistry at the time?
I think Letzinger had done some photochemistry with some organic compounds. Fred Lewis had arrived on the scene as I guess he might have been assistant or associate professor at the time that we were doing it. So we did have some people to turn to. But more than that, I was fortunate in Arthur Adamson sending me a postdoc, a guy by the name of Gaffney, who's now at New York University, I think, and the City University, and Harry was the guy that was able to do this and do it properly and take care of the one graduate student that I had who was working on it. So he was very helpful.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed, and I commented to Dr. Hurd yesterday the same thing, is that his work was very varied, but he had a number of different collaborators. And in some respects, you've done the same thing because you had a paper going way back with Gordon Merrill, and he attributed some of that to just the interaction of the faculty within the Northwestern Department.
Clearly that's true, and you may see some of it as we have lunch today, because that's been going on. It just grew, you know. It was not done by intent. It just happened really when we all arrived at the same time and started eating lunch together and so forth. But as a result of that, Pearson and I started right from the beginning, you know, collaborating and having joint students and joint projects and applying for joint grants. You know, our names would be on it as joint PIs and so forth. And that kind of environment, which grew within the department, has now extended outside of the department, and it's very prevalent. So there's a lot of interdisciplinary stuff going on now. I mean, we have this catalysis group, which Wolfgang Sockler is the Hadiyev professor now, but they managed to get him a new kind of building just adjacent to this annex building, a nice laboratory. But in that laboratory, he has not only chemists, he himself is a chemist, but he has chemical engineers. He has material scientists. He has even physicists or two thrown in, I think. So it's a very interdisciplinary thing. And a lot of the work that's going on now, people doing solid-state work where they're ending up applying to examine electrical properties. There's collaborative work with people in electrical engineering and so forth. So that is something that's kind of unique at Northwestern, and was going on even in the days of Charles Hurd, and certainly in the days when we were getting started and so forth. And I think it's just because the size of the department is small. It's not like a big state school where inorganic chemistry is autonomous from organic, from anything else. From the very beginning, we were small enough that we could kind of interact, and we do interact as a department. We have departmental meetings. The chairman is the chairman, not a head, and we decide policy on the basis of democratic approach. I mean, you have your yeas and nays, and if the yeas are exceed the nays, that's the way it is. And a beginning assistant professor who has just arrived on the scene and doesn't even know where the men's room is, at such a meeting, his vote counts exactly the same as my vote, which I've been here 40 years, for example. And that's fine. That's perfectly all right. We do, of course, have tenure people meeting separate from non-tenure people, naturally. But so the department has always had that kind of thing, and I think it began when a lot of beginning instructors were brought in at the same time, and they began to interact with one another.
You were away from the carbonyl work for a long time, but you got back to it.
Yeah, that's right. And that happened. You know, funding is so much research now is driven by funding. When I first arrived here, there was no place to go for funding, so you didn't have to worry about it. But that's no longer the case, and in fact, I was just writing this morning, just beginning to write this summary thing. We were getting NIH support. I was getting NIH support because of the fact that we were doing solution chemistry of metal complexes. So I would write a research proposal, indicate what we were doing in terms of our studies. And then in one or two sentences only, I would indicate that, gee, this fundamental understanding of these kinds of principles and all of this just has to be of importance to people who are looking at biological systems, whether they be metalloenzymes or metalloproteins and so forth. And that was enough. And NIH would support it. Not only would they support it, they support it for 15 or 20 years. I was even on a panel, an NIH panel years ago, and Henry Taube and I happened to be on at the same time. Just at the time that Senator Manson, proposed a bill in Congress that the federal agencies, other than NSF, well, even NSF, I guess, but the federal agencies should not fund research unless it was closely and directly related to their mission. So it was clear to me, writing was on the wall, that the next time around, chances of getting money from NIH were going to certainly diminish because this was not that close. What they really wanted was some, because their mission is health, they wanted something that would cure a disease, or at least would be related to some health, much closer to health related. Well, I'd always had in mind anyway something that was of interest to me, but just never gotten around to suggesting it to anybody or getting anything started on it, and that was the synthetic oxygen carriers. Because Melvin Calvin, you know, years ago did a lot of this kind of work, but his work was solid state gas phase type interaction, and that was supported during World War II because the Office of Naval Research had money for this purpose of fixing dioxygen. Submarine warfare, you know, you can come to the surface, collect oxygen. When the enemy comes, you can go down and release the oxygen and so forth. And there, it's been known for a long time that there are certain kinds of cobalt-2 chelates that are capable of doing this. And so Calvin published a lot of papers on these cobalt complexes that do that. Well, I decided, gee, let's do some solution chemistry. It won't be all that different. It'll still have to do with kinetics and mechanisms of oxygen uptake and oxygen release and this, that, and the other. So my first student, Al Crumless, who's now a professor of chemistry at Duke University, came by, and that was what he and I decided to do. The reason I wanted to do that, of course, is to do some preliminary work so that then I could write a proposal to NIH and say, look, this is now quite closely related to things of interest to the Institute of Heart and Lung. You know, a lot of the old codgers on the hill are dying of heart attacks and lung cancer and everything else. And so I was pretty sure that this would probably have a much better chance of flying than just the other stuff. And sure enough, it did fly, so then they supported it. And by that time, we had added two or three other inorganic faculty, and so I decided to devote all my time to just the synthetic oxygen work and stop the middle carbonyl work. And then I became president of the ACS, and it was time to write a renewal proposal for the oxygen work, and I did it. But I could have done it better had I really taken the time to do my homework properly. So I got a priority rating that was not fundable, and that it was high enough that they wanted me to resubmit. They encouraged me to resubmit, but I decided the hell with it. I'm getting far enough along that I'm not going to even bother to fight my way to that extent, and I stuck with just doing carbonyl substitution. And by that time, there were several people around here. Bill Trobler was across the hall as an assistant professor, and he and I used to talk about things of mutual interest. The inorganic group here has a very interesting, unique thing. Every Saturday morning, we get together informally and have a chalk talk kind of research conference, not a seminar. We do have a seminar, but that's not it. Something Pearson and I started many years ago. And these Saturday mornings when I'm in town, I'm always there, and I'm always, the name of the game is to, we
which is good for the students and postdocs, is they have to be able to present what they want without slides or transparencies, and they have to be able to respond to questions and comments, on their feet. And so a lot of interruptions, and I ask a lot of questions and a lot of suggestions. In fact, I have a little plaque that was given to me at Mazzolo 70, which comes as a result of this. This guy now is professor at Colorado State University. He was a student, not of mine. He was a student of Shriver's, but he was doing some work, and he was suggesting that such and such was going to happen. And I said, oh, no, that's not the way it'll be. I'll bet you a quarter. My limit is always a quarter. And over the years, I've lost a few quarters, but by and large, I've won most of them. And the reason is, these guys don't realize what they're doing, and they're usually specific about what's going to happen. And usually, my bet is that isn't what's going to happen. And I don't limit myself to the fact that this is what's going to happen, but something else other than that's going to happen. Usually, I have in mind what's going to happen, but my chance of winning is much better than theirs, because in order for them to win, they would have to have specifically that one thing that they say is going to happen. So anyway, kids know that Masolo is going to ask a lot of questions on Saturday morning at these things.
Well, I remember that I found that to be the most valuable experience I had as a graduate student.
Giving seminars
and having, knowing you had to be responsible for what you were saying.
Absolutely.
And prepared.
I think our students really are very well prepared when they leave here, whether it be industry or what, because if we don't try to embarrass them, we try to, we just try to engage them in conversation and challenge them a little bit and so forth.
Yes, at Valparaiso, we had to start giving seminars in our junior year as an undergraduate. We had four full semesters. When I got to graduate school, giving a seminar in front of my colleagues was an old experience.
Old hat, sure.
Whereas some of my peers had never given one in their life. And,
it makes a difference, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Well, why don't we move into your reluctant candidacy as president of the ACS.
Okay.
I guess I could use that term correctly.
Well, whatever.
it was not something that you sought out specifically.
That's true. I had never been really active at the national level in the American Chemical Society, or even at the local level. But I had been, chairman of the inorganic division of the American Chemical Society, so that is at the national level. And I'd always expressed my views when I had views, and I always have some views. And they're usually not mainstream views. And so on this one occasion, there were two candidates that had been nominated for president-elect, and there were some people out there that didn't want either one of them to win for whatever the reason. And I had a couple, two or three phone calls from people that I had a lot of respect for, saying, look, if you're serious about some of the comments I've heard you made, or if you really want to be of help, why don't you let us petition you for president-elect? I said, oh my God, I don't know that I want to get involved to that extent. It's a lot easier to stand on the sideline, and make comments than it is to grab the ball and start running with it. But I said, look, let me think about it over the weekend, and you can get back to me. And eventually, they talked me into it, and I said, look, I'm not going to raise a finger to get myself elected, but if you guys think it's possible and want to go ahead and so forth, I'll go ahead. And they did, and I did get elected without a second election or anything else. So I came on the scene really as a novice in terms of understanding the bureaucracy in the ACS, the staff bureaucracy, and understanding the good old man type attitude, you know, the guys that have been working at the national level for, well, it's their professional life, really. I mean, some of them spend all their time doing that. Then back home, they do very little. But there, they do a lot, and they do it well. The only one thing that bothered me always was they do it so well that they insist on being reappointed. And it means that it takes up a spot that other people cannot. One thing that they won't do is step aside and let somebody else. And I've never known any organization where you can perpetuate yourself for forever, except the ACS. I mean, other appointments that you have are term appointments. They might be 5 years with a renewal for five, but then it's understood that after that, that's it. And this was one of the things that I wanted to do in the ACS. I didn't care how long. I mean, as long as they could decide how long, whether 10 years was the right number of total years or whether 12 or 15. But some kind of total years, because the first thing that you have to do when you become president-elect of the ACS, first thing they ask you to do is to reappoint people on these various committees. And I got immediately into hot water because there were three or four people there that I just wouldn't appoint because I knew that some people that I thought should really be on such committees, publication or whatever it was. And so I didn't appoint them. And then these people, of course, couldn't understand why they weren't reappointed. Because they'd done such a good job for 20, 30 years on first one committee and then another and so forth. But anyway, I was told to go before committee on committees to explain my position on this. And it was unbelievable, like going into the lion's den. You know, these committees are so huge because everybody gets their way paid at the meeting or whatever. And so they make these committees as big as they could possibly finance. And there must have been 20 or 15 or 20 members in this committee on committees. And when I walked in there to explain where I was coming from and why I was saying this, I could look and I could see all these people, all of them had already been there 20 or so years. And they knew they'd done a good job and would want to continue. They wouldn't want to stop, and that's the whole point of it. And it was kind of this useless exercise on my part. My idea was we should have a bylaw which would limit the total number of years, and that would then make it easier for the president-elect or whoever is appointing things, because people would understand that after they've served their 10 or 12 years or however much, and if you can't do what you think needs to be done in 10 or 12 years, then you damn well ought to step aside and let somebody else try. Well, that was the one thing. The other thing that really blew them out of the water was my insisting that we certainly don't need two national meetings a year. We need only one. And by this time, in 83, it was obvious that scientists, chemists, in this case, are spending so damn much time, symposia, national, international, so forth. There are so many meetings. The big job of someone arranging a program for a meeting is to find a date that doesn't conflict with another meeting. And I, by that time, realized that the ACS, I've been going to ACS meetings, and I knew that if you go into a general, here a general paper, symposia, the inorganic chemists and others, I think, have done a real good job at symposia. They bring in good symposium speakers, and they're very well attended. Everybody wants to go hear Harry Gray or whoever else is, Roe Hoffman or whoever the hell else. But those 15-minute papers or whatever it is, it was embarrassing. I mean, the guy that was talking and the guy that was about to follow him and the projectionist, when they still had a projectionist, and so forth, and there was nobody there. So you couldn't justify it on the basis of the science being reported, and you couldn't justify it on the business, because the board of directors and people like that could meet at other times and if they need to, and committees could meet whenever they needed to meet. And one meeting a year is what most chemical societies have. They don't have multiple meetings. ACS now is gradually going towards 3 meetings a year. We think the Pacific Coast meeting and the Canadian one. So, well, that didn't fly, even though there was this questionnaire that was put out, I guess, with something or other that came out from the ACS asking people whether they would be willing to try this on an experimental basis, and the response was not very great. But of the response, it was 2-1 that it should be tried, at least we could try it. But when it came down to the board decision, there was only one vote in favor of trying it. That was right. My idea, of course, was we could have one meeting a year and we could be more supportive of the regional meetings, because it's getting so expensive to go to these big national meetings, and at least for the graduate students and postdocs, the regional meetings and the places where it could be much more accommodating. And it seemed to me that more could be done there, the effort of the staff, because the staff was also worried, you know, staff, they got a huge staff, and they spend so much time on these national meetings, and no sooner than one is over, they're already working on another one, this, that, the other. And my point was, well, yeah, I don't think you need to worry about it, because you can spend that time on the regional meetings and being helpful there. But no, everybody wanted to go to. There was other reasons. Another reason is, if you have only one national meeting, and if you're really serious about wanting to meet some people at a meeting, and there's only one, then the chances of meeting that person are far greater than if there are 2 or even 3 meetings, because you may go to one, that person may go to another one. So there were reasons for doing this, but the bureaucracy was such that it didn't even get off the ground. The whole point is, these people are voting with their feet, you know, as long as we have 10, 12,000 or 8,000 even, or whatever number it is, that come to these meetings, then the meeting is necessary. But my idea is, a meeting is not necessary. These people come just because there is a meeting. And it's wasteful of time and energy and cost of whatever to go to meetings which are not necessary. We already have far too many meetings. I still feel that way.
Well, I was involved with MARM for a while myself, and there's another whole audience out there of people at small liberal arts colleges, which is I think a reasonable segment, who just don't have the wherewithal financially to go to national meetings.
Of course.
And so once every 5 years, if it's in 100 miles away, you might get there for a couple of days.
Well, you ought to break into the national governance of the society and committees and so forth. Once you get into that category and make friends and so forth and get kept on and on and on and on, you can go to all the national meetings.
Well, I do now as a result of my new association. But
okay.
And that's, you know, that's another thing. I have seen this in local sections where counselors are self-perpetuating for decades.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that also leads us into another thing that you were rather strong about in print, and that is